Okay, welcome to class today. Good to see you. I better get my notes out. Okay, so today we're going to be There's still a hum in the air. Okay. Okay. So, today we're going to be talking about the industrial economy, capitalism with an example of Kitson Kalem. Does anyone know where Kitson Kalem is located? I see some nods. Where?
Along
the Skeeter River area?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Smithers, if you go down to Smithers, to Terrace, right by Terrace.
By Terrace.
Yeah. Okay. Has anyone ever been up along the Skeeter River? A couple? Beautiful place. One of the most beautiful places in the world, bar none. Yeah. You guys ever do any mountain climbing? Fishing, well, fishing, it's a great fishing area. The hillsides, and I just call out to people to walk on them. And I had a couple of schoolhood friends who actually climbed this place called Kvinitsa, which is between Prince Rupert and Terrace. It's about halfway between the two places, a great big bowl where the glaciers carved it out and around, and did an awful lot of climbing in Kvinitsa bowl. It is, however, a rather dangerous place to climb. So we're going to be talking about Kitson Kalem. An example is the article that relates to the article that Jim McDonald wrote that's on the course reading list. And next day we'll talk about John Lutz's paper, that chapter called The White Problem. And that'll be on Friday. We'll talk about that particular paper. But before I begin, questions. We haven't had a chance to pause for a while yet. If you have, what questions do you have? And I'll give you a chance to ask any questions from the material we've covered up to this point in time, or thoughts that have popped up. Just so you know, I can outlast you. So I am expecting at least three questions or comments. Yes.
What are the trade unions presently that have the most, the largest relationships with the British?
So the question. So what would be the trade unions today that might have some of the largest, most significant relationships with First Nations communities today? On the coast, it's the what it used to be called, well, it's still called that, but it's part of the Unifor. It's the United Fishermen Allied Workers Union, in which the majority of the shore plant workers, which are based in Prince Rupert actually, are represented by that particular trade union. Now, the fishing industry has had a long history of involvement. The other industrial sectors tend not to have, interestingly enough. Forestry used to have a lot of unionization, but the unionization rates have shifted and changed. And a lot of the logging, which had First Nations people involved in it, has been shifted from company-run operations to independent contractors cutting on behalf of the large timber licensees, and that has led to a change in unionization, i.e. a diminishment, a lack of unionization in that sector. Still in the plants. That would be the primary sector that remains. Interesting enough, most of the relationships today occur at the government-to-government or company-to-First-Nation level. So just recently in the news, three First Nations in the North Coast signed agreements with the LNG pipeline transmission companies. So Kitsilas, Kitkatla, and one other nation, which I forget, signed a benefit agreement. Another question. Yeah?
When we first arrived, what did like, Europeans offer as trade? What did they have to offer?
Say that again. When
When the Europeans arrived, what goods, what did they have to offer to trade?
What did the Europeans have to offer?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when European vessels first started coming up, what did they have to offer for trade? A lot of the trade goods were textiles, cloth, heavy cloth. But more important than that were metals, like steel. And they steel, or different types of iron, rather, not steel, pardon me, iron and copper. Iron was a utilitarian material used in making into knives and cutting devices, things like that. It was fairly malleable and could be shaped. Copper was more ornamental, decorative, and tied into the wealth economy. But also a lot of pots and cooking utensils, copper, but also iron. So the metal objects were a key thing. William Duncan, the missionary who came to the north part of British Columbia in the mid part of the 1800s, he tried to set up industrial manufacturing plants, making steel buckets, shovels, nails, things like that. He actually found that they couldn't compete with goods being shipped in from New England and Western Europe. And that's a kind of strange thing to think about, that somehow a locally produced good couldn't compete. But because New England had mass production, industrial production, cheap goods, and that we were able to ship it around into the Northwest Coast, what people could produce here was foods, processed foods. You had one question here? So the question is this in historically or contemporary?
Historically?
Contemporary. So the question about whether there are companies that might exist today that engage, that see a value in terms of traditional, you know, sort of indigenous values and principles of operating. The short answer is yes, there are such companies. But they tend to be smaller, tend not to be part of the large scale multinational sector. And very oftentimes they are emerging out of local context with people who've grown up living beside each other or working together. So there's a different kind of dynamic that tends to shape that. Some of the bigger companies, though, like Weyerhaeuser, do talk about environmental values and things like that. It is my observation that while the brochures are quite, how do you say it? Laudatory, the actual on-the-ground practices don't mesh with the sort of Aboriginal liaison offices of the large companies. Okay. Great. Well, that was three questions. Not too painful. And we'll keep doing that off and on as we go through. So, just a quick go over some key terms that I will use as we go along. Just glance, I thought I got rid of those pot lights up there, but apparently not. Anyway, a review of some key terms that I'll use that I'm moving along and talking about this. Terms that are just so you know. So I use the term Kumtsiwa on occasion, or you might see it. This is the Smalek term for non-Indigenous peoples. Smalek is the language in the Tsimshian of the north coast of British Columbia. Every language has a term that refers to other people rather than oneself, and that's what this is the term. And sometimes I use that term. One of the economic categories that's very important to understand to make in making sense of that initial encounter between really in that transition from the maritime fur trade into the industrial resource extraction economy, this concept of primitive accumulation. And this is different than, say, a mercantile exchange, where if I come and I'm going to trade with you, I say, here's something, can you give me that cup of coffee? And what's it worth for you? And you say, well, it's 2 sheets of paper. And so we make a trade. And basically, I don't know and don't care how she's producing that cup of coffee. I just want that cup of coffee. And she doesn't know or care how I'm producing this paper, just need that paper. And we're not trying to control the process, how it's being produced. You're just engaging. Our intersection only occurs at the level of that sort of mercantile exchange. The maritime fur trade was in that order. It was a kind of mercantile capitalism where the value was made by buying something as cheap as you could get it and selling it somewhere else at a higher price. And so for the Europeans, buying the furs from the indigenous peoples in this coast was buying it cheap, selling it at a high price in Japan, in China, and into that wealth economy over there. For the indigenous communities that were getting access to the steel and the textiles and the metal products, that was a scarce resource that was not available, and it gave those who had that a competitive advantage vis-a-vis other indigenous communities. And so it was a form also beneficial. So now, interestingly enough, often the trade documents and the discussions of this period talk about indigenous communities getting access, essentially having wealth ripped and stolen from them at a really low price. And then they talk about trinkets and things like that. Well, that's looking at from one vantage point. And there was that narrative where the traders did think for a lot of cheap pieces of metal and steel or iron, et cetera, they're getting a really high-priced commodity. But also in the indigenous communities, it was getting these really amazing pieces of technology and tools that actually then really shifted their capacity to produce. So if you move from a shell or a stone cutting device to an iron cutting device, you can actually increase your output in terms of you're talking about gutting fish, cleaning animals, carving wood, things like this. It changes your technology, your output. It allows you to do different things, to be more efficient with your labor power. That gives you an amazing advantage in terms of your interaction with people who don't have that. So it was a two-way street, so that interaction is having impacts for both communities. It's having a reverberating spill outwards. But neither party is interested in controlling how the other party is making things. Under capitalism, the capitalism works by controlling labor power, your ability to make something. It actually controls the where, the when, the how. That whole structure is really important for a capitalist economy to work. But at this early stage, you get this kind of thing where people aren't necessarily interested in working in a regulated factory from sun up to sun down and being paid the kind of money. It really compels human beings across the world. We've always had to be compelled in some kind of way. Primitive accumulation is a period of capital, of accumulating wealth and capital at these transition marks. That's one way of thinking of it. Often primitive capitalism is a stage of early capitalist development that uses coercion, legal fictions, like creating, when I say legal fictions, if we read the colonial documents in British Columbia, they'll be called laws. But they're a legal fiction in the sense because it creates a new style, a new way, and implies that there is nothing that went before it. So the crown comes in, establishes a crown colony, enacts legislation, calls it law. It is, in a sense, a kind of legal fiction that's creating a new regime in place. And if you take a look at the whole history of so-called wildlife harvesting, fisheries, infractions for over a century or more, it shows that the crown, the state, has really not been effective at enforcing its control over law. So there's the crown's ability to, or the state's ability to regulate or to control is limited to the extent to which people accept the legitimacy of the state. And so you get these moments where sometimes the state might call it illegality, but it also shows a situation of the lack of governability that's occurring. So you get coercion, legal fiction, and then a whole range of other kinds of unscrupulous techniques that you could simply call theft. And so in the establishment of the early fishing industry and setting places up, you had a whole range of techniques that the early fish canners in the logging industry, the early logging techniques of setting plants, where they essentially did not pay attention to indigenous presence in these places, or sometimes they were compelled to purchase rights. And then they used armed state power, or sometimes privatized armed power, to actually compel people to do things. And then that's all working. It's not like in the, up and down the coast, in the interior in different ways. When you then ride in the other factors that are going along with the issue of the expansion of disease and disruption that occurs through this moment of time, you have a period of massive disruption and unrest, which, you know, that's when they, even in our history terms, we call the so-called robber barons who turn up, the people who build up the coal fields in Nanaimo, or the hard rock mining and trail. The early founders in the Bell Irving family in terms of the fishing industry in this province, McMillan moving from government control over the forestry branch to owning one of the biggest forest companies in the province through a kind of delightful combination of state authority and power and private enterprise. If you take a look at the early sort of government and business history in British Columbia from about the 1860s through to the 1920s, 30s, you see an awful lot of the same kind of criticism that contemporary political economists talk about failed states or states that are corrupt states, graft-type states. The correspondence between the government bureaucracy, and the business class in this province was very, very tight. And there was it wasn't really seen to be an issue through that many of those early decades. Some political commentators and critics might suggest that continues to this day, though oftentimes today the political rules and regulations are more clearly defined, and people can, such as Bill Vanderzam. Few of you here probably will remember Bill Vanderzam, rather interesting premier of British Columbia, who basically had to resign over a real estate deal with a Hong Kong realtor and his fantasy garden. He actually called it fantasy garden development out in Richmond, I think it was. But the rules, there was a time, say 100 years before Bill Vanderzam had that experience, that wouldn't have been considered a problem for the ruling elites. So that's the idea of primitive accumulation. The other notion, the term social class, that I'll use, and I use in a very particular way. Now, class, and I don't want to give you guys a whole sociology kind of mini lecture here, so I'm just going to make it really simple and short to the point. There's two general types of idea of social class that are used. One is a notion of like a birthday cake, one layer piled on top of the other. People will talk about the bottom fifth compared to the top fifth. Or in CBC News right now, they've been playing some accounts, or I think it was on The Current, which is a radio current affairs program, talking about a recent Oxfam report that says 80 top earners in the world control, or either not today or soon will, have as much wealth as the bottom 50% of the world's population. And so that is a type of social class that's based upon relative rank and distribution of a key kind of resource. The way in which I typically use social class talks about class as a person's relation to the tools and the things of production. So you might think, if you look at, say, a fish cannery, you would have the people who are running the cannery, owning the cannery, are one class, social class, and the people who are working for the cannery are another social class. So that's a model of social class that requires a relationship, and it's focused on points of production. So that's very helpful for looking at issues of work, industry, the development of these kind of economic processes. But these other types of class that link to social prestige, that kind of cultural wealth, is a different type of class. And oftentimes the economic class of social relations, classes of social relationship, don't directly correspond to the kind of social class that might relate to prestige or cultural value. The anthropologist Noel Dick, who is, works at SFU, I did courses with him when I was an undergraduate many years ago. He wrote a number of papers, and he did some of his early work in Saskatchewan, working with an Aboriginal communities in Saskatchewan. And he would talk about this gentleman who would come and speak to church groups and community groups about the about Aboriginal rights in Saskatchewan. And this was a man of immense talent and power and prestige and placement in his society. And one of the Noel point out is that the man, from a social economic perspective, was the janitor in one of the local schools. And so there's this kind of class distinction between the economic and the social roles. But in the world of account, this man was an important man. And so when I say that the social classes tell us one thing, they help us tell us one thing, but there's other types of class or notions of how people belong in relation to society. And so it depends upon what you are interested in. So if you're interested in looking at the economic relationships within a particular school, social class, person's employment status, and those kind of status things that emerge that are important. If you're looking at the role that this gentleman played in his home community, in the connection to speaking to non-Indigenous people about issues of Aboriginal rights and title, his economic identity has absolutely nothing to do with it and will tell you nothing about his capacity or what he's saying or his place. So it's important to keep these kind of ideas, depending upon what you're doing, is how we use them. So when I use the term social class sometimes, I'm typically talking about the economic relations. Very, very quickly, social relations of production, because I use these terms around, these are ways in which things that are being produced for human use is organized. So if you think about the social relations of production, the social relations, how we're connected to each other of production. So if you're talking about in the traditional kin order society along the coast, where a hereditary leader could call upon members of his house group to engage in productive work, the social relationship is defined by kinship. It's who I'm related to, who I'm connected to, gives me my obligations, my rights, and my responsibilities are linked in there. If you're looking again at the shop floor of, say, of a car factory, the social relations are defined by one's place on the production line assembly, and your relationship with your employer is through what's sometimes called in the technical term a cash nexus. Your relationship comes through cash, i.e. I give you my labor, you give me some cash. That's the relationship. So social relations of production are the way in which we organize ourselves as a society to produce certain types of goods. And means of production, when I use that, it's simply the tools. Tools, but also, and the knowledge. So means of production is not simply just tools and techniques, but it's how you use those tools is also part of this. Sometimes referred to as the material forces of production, but the means of production. Okay. So those are some of the technical terms that I will bring up, and you'll hear me mention, and you need to sometimes just signpost them in case as I'm going along. So let's move to the case study. Well, you know, maps are always interesting because you realize that embedded within maps is a whole bunch of hidden knowledge and assumed knowledge. This map is really helpful if you can see it, for one thing, because it's very faint. But also, if you actually know where this is in the province. My apologies for not actually having a contextualizing map showing where this is in the province. If you imagine British Columbia up as a kind of rectangle, Prince Rupert out in the coast, Haida Gwaii sitting off the coast, the Skeena River going from just below Prince Rupert up to Terrace, and Skeena River is just cutting through the bottom of this chart, I believe. So we've got Terrace is sitting about here, Terrace, British Columbia, and then you go up a little bit, and the Prince George is over and up here. Prince George is a little bit further to the north and much to the east. And those words, Lac Nibu, Lascique, Ganhada, Gitzbewada, are clan names referring to particular territories. Now, before the arrival of Europeans. This was controlled by Kitson Caleb. This was Kitson Caleb territory. The rules and protocol for access, for use, was defined by a CIMCM protocol of requesting access, if you were, or depending through your family, who your family was, would give you access to certain types of resources in this area. One of the things that's happened over the last 100 years is that the effect of control of this area has been shifted. And so one of the key questions that Jim McDonald in his paper about the Kitson-Caleb case asks is, how did ownership and control shift from Kitson-Caleb to industrialists? So how did the actual control over what was happening shift? And then how was Kitson-Caleb labor diverted into the capitalist economy? Because it doesn't necessarily follow. I mean, we look at today, we say, well, this is logical. We have industrial logging going on. We have some sawmills, we have mining in the area, we have fisheries, energy export, it seems natural. We have a big town of Terra sitting there, we've got Kitimat just down the ways where all the oil refinery, they want to put the oil refinery, etc. But actually, when you stood on the ground there, say in 1860, there was no obvious reason that it would go the way that it would. You couldn't necessarily foretell how that would happen. So that's the question that Jim asked. On a little side, Jim McDonald, who is a faculty member at the University of Northern British Columbia, did his PhD at UBC in the late 70s, early 1980s, and he did his work predominantly with Kitson-Caleb. And in the introduction to his dissertation, he talks about how he had an idea of going and trying to do something, wasn't quite sure, and he turned up in a Kitson-Caleb band office in the late 70s, and said, is there anything that you could do with a graduate student who wants to do some project? And he said, for his good fortune, they actually did have some work, and they put him to work doing researching information, because they were preparing different types of rights-type court cases around that period of time. And that's led to close to 3.5 decades of close collaboration between himself and Kitson-Caleb and the treaty office there, has also had a number of different students working with him, have worked in that particular community. Now, Kitson-Caleb's property was concentrated around the Caleb River and Lake. This is, if the Nisga is just a little bit to the north of this area with the Nass River. You have Kitsilis, which is another Simpson community, a bit to on the canyon of the Skeena River Canyon, a little bit to the east. And then out to the coast, you have Lac Aux Lambs, or the allied Simpson tribes on the coast and the mouth of the Skeena River. And then if you keep going further to the west, you come to Kakatla and then Haida on Haida Gwaii. Now, this is an interesting point, and it's kind of, because sometimes when we think about marginalization and displacement, we sometimes think of it, or we are more likely to think of it, as a physical displacement, a physical marginalization. I'm also pushing aside. And one of the things that Jim's work has shown is that you have this way in which capitalist development occurred in this way, is you had this shift from being, where Kitson-Caleb was part of an important regional economy, engaged in producing goods, engaged in an exchange network that extended all the way up past the Kispiox in the interior, up into the Nass area toward the Tulten around the Sakin, out to the west, the Haida, down the coast, an area that was, about 400 or 500 miles kind of in diameter, radius, sort of, I guess, yeah, radius. 300-400, radius at least in that kind of circle, and that was just the kind of immediate social world. And Kitson-Caleb was a critical component within this regional economy. But as the industrial economy developed, they became, as he frames it, apart from the economy, without physically being moved. And he said, so what happens here? What is occurring? One of the key things, and this is one of the fundamental differences about capitalist form of production compared to other types of economic structures, is this idea, the desire to control, this a notion of economic control. So sometimes you have a situation where you might actually own a particular resource. So I might actually own a woodlot, and I might cut the timber, and I might own that timber, but I may not actually have economic control of it. I don't control the main features of the larger global marketplace. That there might be thousands and thousands of other little people with small woodlots who are controlling the price. And because of that, that diminishes my capacity and compels me, even though I'm totally in charge of how I cut my own wood, compels me to behave in the same way as everybody else in order to participate. So there's this alienation of economic control in terms of the land. Furthermore, there's an actual erosion of possession, direct control. And Jim documents, both in this paper and a number of other papers, the kind of the slow bleeding away of possession and control the Kitson Kalem had over their house territories. So the incursion, for example, of the railway through Kitson Kalem territory, how it took chunks of land away and then shifted the actual ability to have take possession. To have possession of something means the ability to do something with it, to control it, to occupy it, to own it, to use it, to control other people's use of it. You also saw with the development of industrial logging the change of the landscape. But in another paper he writes about berry harvesting, a very interesting paper in a book published, edited by Nancy Turner and Douglas Dewar. I forget the exact title, but if you do a Google search of Nancy Turner, you'll find this particular book, where he describes how for many, many millennia, berry patches like huckleberries and blueberries and cranberries were tended in a variety of different mechanisms. Not necessarily tended like they do out here in the big industrial blueberry farms or cranberry farms where there's a lot of heavy machinery and it's really obvious. It's a different type of tending where there was human intervention, modification, use of fire, returning to the patches over and over, an idea that they belong to particular groups of people. One of the things that industrial logging does is remove the timber, and especially the early period of logging in this province. It removed not just the timber, it cut down everything, burned stuff that was in the way, used the gravel from salmon beds to build roads, actually ran their heavy equipment through the streams and creeks and things like that. And so what that does is now when you used to have a tended, managed for generations a patch of, say, huckleberries, now you have a clear cut open, and you might for a while, a few years afterwards, have a profusion of berries coming up again, but the change that's happened is it's no longer the same place. Landscape's been completely transformed. So you have this erosion of possession occurring. So you have between the alienation of economic control, the erosion of possession, you find that the community, the Kibitz and Kalem, are having it harder and harder to actually have the means to meet the daily livelihood. At the same time, the colonial regime creates what this is called, this idea of a traditional sector. This is not unique to British Columbia, not unique to Canada. You find it globally in colonial regimes, but the British had perfected a very particular model. You see it at the same point in time, the same time this is happening in British Columbia, it's happening in a little bit later, a couple decades or so later in East Africa, so they're informed by what's happening here. You see it in India. Essentially, the idea is you use legislative controls to create a commercial economy where you have to access it only by license of the government, and then a so-called traditional economy that's reserved for indigenous people to meet food needs and social or ceremonial needs. And so what that does, across the range of harvested goods, criminalizes non-certified government practices that are not certified or licensed by the government. So that means if you go with the Provincial Wildlife Act that was introduced in the late 1800s, if you shoot a deer or a moose or an elk without a provincial license, you've committed a criminal offense. The only people who can sell any wild game, wild forest products, fish, etc., are those who are licensed by the government. So what that does, when you combine that with the erosion of economic possession and the alienation of economic control, you now have a legal mechanism to coerce and compel people. So in order to make them enough, I mean, you can get a little bit of food to fish, but there's a lot of things you need the cash economy for. You restrict it so that you are now compelled to work in these other places. So the first two categories, about alienation of economic control and possession, are about gaining control over the resources, the things that are being modified and extracted. This next one is about creating a captured pool of labor that compels people and forces them to work in a particular direction. And this is particularly important with the development of these commercial activities that are apart and separate from the traditional sector. And this device, from undermining Kikuyu agricultural practices in Kenya, to the creation of an industrial fishery in British Columbia, is a standard practice, a mechanism to actually coerce and compel people to participate in the mainstream economy, in a particular economy. But of course, the rules of engagement, therefore, in that moment, became shifted and transformed, because now who controlled it? The people who came in with the legal apparatus, who had been engaged in an early period of so-called primitive accumulation, using British gunships, using different types of military policing forces, utilizing judicial enforcement of laws upon people, so-called hanging Judge Begbie, for example. When you look at what's going on there, Begbie, more than not so much bringing law and order, he's participating in the extension of the state's capacity to enforce its control over people. It's part of the colonial mechanism of transforming. It's a form of regime change that's being enforced upon people. An interesting way of going. So that model, so what that did is by the, so this is the period is used developing along through the early part of the 20th century, the development of the resource extraction economy. This is the model that basically held things in play. But it hasn't remained this way. And it's quite interesting how these things have shifted. one of the things that's occurred is through litigation, it's the Aboriginal communities have, through successive court cases, demonstrated and have the courts have decided this to be the case, have shown that the Crown actually acted illegally in many cases. Now, this is an interesting thing. I mean, there's no way the guys who were setting these rules up, say, in 1912, when they had their various different types of royal commissions going around the province, talking about labor, talking about Aboriginal property and rights and things like that, there's no way that they would have ever conceived that barely 100 years later, not even 100 years later, their decisions would have been seen to be, in a sense, illegal, that they were put the honor of the Crown in disrepute. So this starts to shift the game, the structure, but at the same time, the economic base of the province has shifted. We no longer are a heavy labor-involved resource extraction province. A lot of resource extraction. We're still, if you take a look at the economy, also another news thing this morning with the dropping of the overnight lending rates by 20, I think by a quarter of a point, all designed, according to the governor of the Canadian Bank of Commerce, to improve what? Export of raw goods. Not necessarily energy goods, because the energy, the oil and gas prices are dropping, but raw resources and other exporting goods from Canada are always facilitated when our dollar drops, and by dropping the interest rate, they've dropped this. So we still have lots of resources in this economy to be developed, but the labor power involved in processing and extracting them has been massively reduced. And if you do the sort of the labor force calculations and take a look at both the distribution of where people live in this province, where the work sites are, even though you might have the same number of board feet of lumber being exported, say, from the Houston Timber Products mill, you have nowhere near the same number of people in that mill working there. So these dynamics have changed. Now the game isn't about how much labor power, which an individual coming to get a job, but very oftentimes these discussions are occurring at the level of political leadership in Aboriginal communities and business companies. And you start seeing where now, because of this history of court cases and because the governments before didn't act legally, didn't respect the honour of the Crown, they are now setting up a whole range of business arrangements or economic benefit agreements, and First Nations have to be listened to. And it's an interesting dynamic, what's going on. And just in the same way that I think it was called Williams Fishing Company Limited, somewhere around the 1880s, somewhere between 1880 and 1890, signed an agreement with Samoigat Sebasa in Kakatla Territory, $100 for 5 years of rent of one salmon creek. And the government may have said, you don't really have to do that, but they, in order to get the fish, Williams Fishing Company signed that deal. The same way today, the large companies, to facilitate their access and their movement of goods, are signing deals. So recently, I think I mentioned earlier, the pipeline transmission deal that was signed between three First Nations around the two transmission lines into the Prince Rupert area, which apparently it's each of the First Nations are receiving close to $1 million, been in staggered funding, and then another fund of $10 million that they're sharing from. Relative to the flow, the profit and capital flow through in these firms, that's nothing. You know, that's another side thing. But that's where this has actually shifted. So it shifted to a different dynamic. And we won't today talk about, but it's a question worth thinking about and trying to consider, is what are the economic dynamics occurring, these kind of changes? So when you shift from the basis of engagement as a labor force within an industrial extractive industry to now sitting at negotiating benefits agreements from one First Nation to a business, it changes things. The cast of people are quite different. So alongside today's negotiations, you probably have accountants, lawyers, various types of business operators advising the political leadership. In the past, people who were organizing these things from the indigenous leadership were also tied to trade union organization and a different kind of political mentality or outlook. So the key point today that I want to think about and talk for McDonald's paper, going back to the Kitson-Kalem case, is here's a situation where a community who was actively engaged in the industrial economy, in fishing and forestry, I have spoken to a number of the gentlemen who say people who are, particularly men, but also women, who say 60 and older, and that generation all the way back to most of the 20th century worked in fisheries or forestry, either as falling, running fish boats, on the decks of fish boats, or in sawmills in the Terrace Prince Rupert area. Women mostly worked as shore labor or working on fish boats, but also shore labor in the fish processing plants. Through that, you had essentially 80 to 90% employment. At the same time, it was on resources and in context in which the community had lost its ability to have economic control and was compelled to work in these areas. But as the economy shifted, the unemployment rates massively skyrocketed as the economic opportunities become totally transformed in these places. Finally, it's this notion about how displacement can occur even while a person is sitting where they have always been. This notion of being dislocated. And it rides on the same time with notions, real strong notions of that constitute home, where people feel attachments to home, but somehow, while the home in one sense is really seen as a powerful metaphor and a connect, a real empirical, physical thing, a connection to a place, it's also felt that place, that home, has been dislocated and dislodged. And so I often find at times, going back to Lac-Clan, the village, and meeting with young kids who are there and living there, that they feel, they use a term like that you hear, you know, that it's a rock, an isolated place. And there's this sense of dislocation that comes from being shifted. Yet that's a center of such a wealthy, rich place. And so part of it is trying, and the only way that sense and that sort of personal sense coming back of wealth comes back is when people have control and the authority and the jurisdiction and the sovereignty over one's own place is returned and is acknowledged and understood. And that's part of what's happening with some of these business arrangements that's occurring nowadays. It's a way of enacting that out. So we'll stop here for today. And then we'll pick up with the white problem on Friday, the chapter from John Lutz's book.